Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
It's kind of amazing, isn't it, how every day the government just magically comes up with more money to fix the economy. Today, it's another $800 billion on the taxpayers' balance sheet as the Federal Reserve keeps on a-trying. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. The Marketplace Entrepreneurship Desk is supported by the Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, the foundation of entrepreneurship. Online at kauffman.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Tuesday, the 25th of November. Great to have you with us, as always. Let's review for a minute before we really get rolling here, because to understand why the Federal Reserve did what it did today, you need to remember what they've done so far, on interest rates in particular. The federal funds rate, the short-term interest rate that the Fed controls, sits at 1% as we speak. That means there's not too much room left to cut to get the economy going again. So what else can they do? Give away money is the short answer, which gets us to today. The latest installment of the bailout comes with an $800 billion price tag. For the first time, the powers that be are really going to target consumer loans and mortgage-related debt. The problem is that financial institutions haven't been able to bundle up those loans and resell them in what's called the secondary market, so there's not enough money to make more loans. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports from North Carolina Public Radio that what the Fed's trying to do is to get that secondary market working again.
When you get a loan for a house or a car, it's usually bundled up with other loans. Those asset or mortgage-backed securities are sold to investors all over the world. Your bank then uses the money from the sale to make even more loans. But Wachovia economist Mark Vittner says this consumer loan market has pretty much shut down.
And if no one's willing to buy those consumer loans, then the people that are originating them simply do not have the capital to continue to originate them.
The Federal Reserve's new plan aims to get the banks lending again. It will loan up to $200 billion to support consumer and small business loans, and it'll buy $600 billion worth of mortgage-backed securities. Duke University professor Stephen Schwartz says the Fed's moves should make more loans available.
We're going to provide the funding, and we're going to stabilize market prices.
So now the government will become a new buyer of consumer debt like student loans and credit card loans. These aren't the toxic loans that no one wants. They're highly rated loans that should be attracting buyers. But even if they do, more liquidity doesn't guarantee that banks will make more consumer loans or that consumers will spend more and revive the economy. Len Blum at investment bank Westwood Capital says it's like the old adage, you can't push on a string.
Which means you can't make a bank lend. You can make them put the money out there, but if the bank is concerned about credit risk, they just won't lend.
Blum's also concerned that the Fed's plan to buy up mortgages is too general.
It isn't specifically targeting first-time buyers, home purchases rather than refinancing, or the purchase of existing home stock or foreclosures.
But the plans already had the desired effect. Mortgage rates posted a record one-day drop today, presumably in response to the Fed's actions. I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
All right, so in the best-case scenario, the Fed buys up outstanding mortgages. That pumps more money into the market for new home loans. The banks start lending. That pushes interest rates lower. More people start borrowing and buying, and pretty soon we're all recession? What recession? Well, we asked our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, to track down the answer to another question. Is this going to work?
There is reason to hope this is more than wishful thinking. Standard & Poor's chief economist David Weiss says, although the credit markets are still in turmoil, the Fed has achieved limited success with similar actions, such as buying up corporate IOUs to get business credit circulating again.
Some of the programs have been effective. The Fed's direct purchases of commercial paper, for example, seem to have freed up the commercial paper market. They're hoping that this will do the same thing for the mortgage market.
But will this latest shot in the arm spur any more bank lending than all the others before it?
I don't know. I can't tell you.
Gary Schilling heads an investment advisory firm.
They'd be delighted if lending were to pick up, but I think in reality they are simply trying mightily to stabilize the situation and prevent widespread financial collapse.
S&P's David Weiss says this is uncharted territory, so nobody can be sure this will be effective, but he says policymakers can't sit idly by.
This looks like it should work. Let's try it. If it doesn't work, well, we try something else.
Still, investment advisor Axel Merck worries there are limits to how much the Fed can spend.
Right now, the Federal Reserve is pretty much the counterparty to all economic activity in the country, it seems. And that by itself cannot be sustainable.
Merck says the government needs to steady the credit markets, but should avoid propping up the economy. It might be painful, he argues, but only when housing prices and other markets hit bottom can a true recovery begin. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
I don't know if you noticed, but we've been talking about the bailout plan for, what, like 4 minutes now, and nobody has said the words Treasury Department or Henry Paulson. That's not us missing something, it's just the politics of it. The Treasury Department's rescue plan is looking a whole lot different now than what was sold to Congress in September. And with so much taxpayer money on the line, our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale reports the tab is getting bigger than lawmakers ever imagined.
Only $20 billion of the $800 billion in taxpayer loans announced today comes from the congressionally approved TARP bailout. The rest will be put up by the Federal Reserve Bank. And Bob Eisenbeiss, who used to be an economist at the Atlanta Fed, thinks he knows why.
It's all money out of the same pot, in a sense, except one doesn't have to get approval from Congress to use the Federal Reserve's balance sheet.
Eisenbeiss says the Treasury Department wants to keep the bailout money in reserve for the next administration. Roughly half of that $700 billion has been committed. But with all the changes in the bailout, New Jersey Republican Representative Scott Garrett says Congress is feeling some buyer's remorse. He voted against the bailout because he didn't think there was enough accountability for taxpayer money.
I think most people who voted yes thought that they were buying a certain program, that is, buying mortgage-backed securities, and that was it. Now, of course, they say, wait a minute, it's not that. Now it went to something else, and maybe it's back to buying mortgage-backed securities. And, oh, by the way, the Federal Reserve's doing it, too. So I think the people who voted yes are probably going to be the ones leading the charge, saying, wait a minute, let's take a second look at what we authorized here.
And members of Congress know there's an extra reason they'll be held responsible for the success or failure of the taxpayer bailout, says Bob Eisenbeiss.
The current administration is not going to be around when that assessment takes place.
In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
Administrations come and administrations go, but problem banks tend to linger for a while. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation released its quarterly list of troubled banks this morning. There are 50% more of them now than there were 3 months ago, 171 in all. To be fair, that is just a drop in the bucket of the 8,500 banks the FDIC insures, but still. On Wall Street today, a win by the hair on your chinny chin chin. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Months and one global economic crisis later, a deal for what could have been the world's biggest mining company has come to naught. A year and a half ago, commodity prices were on their way to record highs. Mining company stocks were soaring. And the Australian mining giant BHP Billiton decided it was a good time to get bigger. It launched a hostile bid for its smaller British rival, Rio Tinto. At one point, the deal was worth almost $200 billion. And then subprimes happened. The global economy slowed, commodity prices collapsed as demand tailed off, and today BHP walked away, as Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
The Rio Tinto takeover today is valued at $60 billion. That's a 70% drop in just a matter of months. Rod Eggert is an economics professor at the Colorado School of Mines. He says the turnaround in metal and mineral prices is simply unprecedented.
The rise in prices over the last 5 years was longer and higher than is normal, and the fall in prices over the last several months was quicker than anything I can remember or know about.
The global economic downturn has driven down demand for commodities like iron ore, copper, and coal. And with the credit markets in shambles, now certainly not a time for BHP Billiton to take on the billions in debt that the takeover would have required.
In many ways, BHP's been lucky that they've had the chance to call off the deal.
That's Chris Hind, editorial director of Mining Journal. He says European regulators would have forced the combined company to sell off assets in iron ore and coal to lessen its power over the steel industry. But those sales would be worth a lot less now than even a few months ago. The global downturn has derailed several big mining mergers of late. But with metal prices way down, mining giants may still be eyeing some smaller takeovers. Rod Eggert.
The market probably has overreacted in terms of devaluing many of the smaller and junior companies. And I think in an opportunistic way, some of the larger companies will take advantage of this.
Some analysts say cash-rich China could get involved as well. China has already begun to snap up mining companies in Africa. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Here's today's not-so-fun fact about the economy. According to the Department of Labor, there were 2,100 mass layoff events last month. A mass layoff, the government says, is 50 or more people at a single company losing their jobs. The grand total for October came to almost 250,000 people getting pink-slipped. And remember, that doesn't count Citigroup's huge cuts from just last week. Whether the firings come in bunches or if they come one by one, it's never fun to be on the receiving end. But it's not too much better for those who are left behind. From New York, Sally Herships has more.
What do you think is worse, getting laid off or dodging the axe? It's a no-brainer, right? Losing your job. Internet project manager Heather Flett used to agree. Then the dot-com bubble burst earlier this decade.
I think I counted somewhere between 19 and 23 different rounds of layoffs.
But wait a second, 23 rounds of layoffs?
Yeah.
At first, Flett says the pink slippings at her dot-com were surprising and scary. Something to be avoided at all costs. But things quickly got tough.
It was really sad. So it was hard to pick up the extra slack of doing other people's jobs. It was hard to see our friends leave. It was hard to be in a scary environment.
And the layoffs kept going on. The axe continued chopping for 5 years. And by the final rounds, when most of the desks around her were empty, Flett had changed her mind. She wanted out.
The 17th and 18th, okay, this is not a surprise, you know, please make the pain stop.
If you feel stress, your body doesn't care what you're worried about. Your body just knows there's a stressful situation out there. That's according to psychologist Mitchell Marks.
If you lie awake at night and can't sleep because you're worried about losing your job, that is as stress-inducing as actually losing your job.
Marks teaches management at San Francisco State. He says downsizing seems irrational to employees, good workers getting the boot for no good reason. And that, he says, can cause competition among the ranks, employees pitted against their own supposed teammates. Why do people stick around in these situations?
People hate change. Do you know anyone who's in a relationship and you look at it and you say, why does he or she stay with that person? Well, why does he or she stay at that job?
But can a bad job really be worse than no job? I met up with Chris Connor outside of his neighborhood grocery store. Until a few weeks ago, he was a retail exec. Then he got laid off. Now he's clipping coupons from the circular.
The person who you thought you had a great rapport with and they just totally dumped you for no reason, that's what getting laid off feels like.
Just like you'd think, Connor says the financial stress of being laid off is enormous. But Mitchell Marks of San Francisco State says Connor has a leg up. Unlike the workers stuck in a bad relationship, he can move on. He just has to work through some stuff.
So first there's denial. Oh, they're going to get over it. They're going to change. They can't really be doing this. Then there's anger. You know, how could these people do such a thing to other human beings?
Then comes bargaining, depression, and finally acceptance. Connor again.
I no longer will ever walk into that building and feel like, is today my last day? Am I going to get escorted out like a criminal today? It's over. It's done.
Chris Connor is still looking for a job, but it's only been a few weeks. Dot-com survivor Heather Flett, after staring at the axe through 23 rounds of layoffs, couldn't take it anymore. She left, on her own. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, one scholar's prescription for change.
I want efficiency and I want justice. I want freedom and I want security. Now, as an economist, I know that there have to be trade-offs.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 36 points today, 0.4% to close at 84.79. The Nasdaq clipped off 7 points, down about 0.5%, ended at 14.64. The S&P 500 tacked on 5.2%, finished at 8.57. Financial stocks and retailers got a boost from that Fed announcement. J.P. Morgan jumped nearly 8%. Walmart rang up 3.6%. But a bunch of lousy economic news, things like the economy shrinking faster than expected and consumer spending falling at the most dramatic rate in 28 years, hurt technology stocks. Apple bid off 2.3%. Technology bellwether Cisco Systems unloaded 6% today. The 10-year T-note gained. The yield slipped to 3.09%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at splendidtable.org. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, explainers, and videos. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its monthly personal income and spending report just in time for Black Friday. The Commerce Department also reports on durable goods orders and new home sales for October. And Peanuts creator Charles Schulz was born on November 26, 1922. Just a friendly reminder to set your DVR next month for a Charlie Brown Christmas. It's been around since 1965. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
Lots of you have had thoughts about our coverage of the auto industry the past couple of weeks, so I figure we'll start there. The big three are in limbo about what kind of help they might get, if any. Congress is going to hear Detroit's pleas to avoid bankruptcy once again after Thanksgiving. Ho-Fuan Ng from Colorado Springs, Colorado, points out that Chapter 11 doesn't always mean the end.
They can wipe out all legacy problems and start with a clean slate. This would make them more competitive and hopefully more agile.
Martin Sager of Ann Arbor, Michigan, not too far from Detroit, says that even though Detroit CEOs didn't make a good case while they were in Washington, what they really do need is time.
The auto industry saw the writing on the wall and started retooling a couple years ago to become much leaner. We need to give them a chance to complete that transformation and start bringing those new products to market.
Speaking of products and markets, a couple of weeks ago we brought you a story about buyer's remorse, people buying something and then turning around and taking it right back after they realize they can't afford it. Craig Ward's a bicycle retailer in Sterling, New Jersey. He says serial returners ought to think about the cost before they buy.
Those who shop for thrill cost retailers something that can't be recovered, our time.
Last week, our series Working profiled a miner in the Congo. A lot of you wrote to say that that story was a great example of what a global economy means to people outside this country. Andrew Jacknane from Washington, D.C. said the story touched him for a different reason.
There seemed to me to be a universality in this story for all people who have to face deprivation, all people who have a very difficult time keeping their family together.
On that theme of family, Jose Velez of Dallas, Texas, wrote in response to our report last week, the one that said some financial businesses that aren't banks are trying to become banks so they can get their hands on bailout money. He says taxpayers could learn a thing or two.
Why don't struggling American families start applying for bank status so that they can get some bailout money too?
Finally this week, Scott Swing from Los Gatos, California, wrote with this. He says he's tired of hearing about the Troubled Asset Relief Program, or TARP. With all the changes in the way that plan's being carried out by Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson, the name needs to change too.
Credit Relief Alternative Plan.
Think about it for a second. All right. If you have a comment about the fallout from the financial crisis, our coverage of it, or what you think it ought to be called, go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. It's healthy sometimes to step back, away from the daily grind of the fallout from the financial crisis. So today we're going to continue with Taking Stock, our series of occasional conversations with people who can give us the long view of our economic situation. Obviously, there are a lot of needs that have to be met right now. Help for homeowners, insurance for the unemployed, not to mention car makers and banks and home builders. But that forgets some of the problems that were around before the crisis and that will become more important once we do struggle through it. Stanford University economist Victor Fuchs has devoted the better part of his career to healthcare policy. So I asked him the most important thing that we, as a society, ought to be thinking about as we go through this very tumultuous time.
For me, and this is a matter of values, a good society is one that encourages, that develops, and honors both individual and social responsibility. We have tilted too far in the direction of individual responsibility. So if the balance is going to swing, it needs to swing back toward social responsibility. For example, I'm in favor of having some kind of healthcare system where everybody gets coverage for a basic plan.
And it gets very quickly into a discussion of politics, too, doesn't it? I mean, none of this comes without political discussion.
Right. But the recent elections suggest that the public, the body politic, is ready to make some kind of swing in the direction that I'm talking about. It won't come easily. For example, to get universal coverage for health care, that's going to take some fundamental changes.
Why is it that health care always seems to get worse and worse? The problem is more expensive. It's harder to fix. Why does that happen?
Well, I'm not sure that it gets worse and worse. I would rather say it gets more expensive and more expensive. I don't think health care is worse today than it was 5 years ago or 10 years ago. I think it's better, but it just costs us too much.
How do you get those costs under control in an environment where there are so many other things demanding money and political attention?
Well, we've inherited two ways of doing health care, both of which I think are inefficient and inequitable. One is the employment-based system, and the second is the income-tested system like Medicaid. If people were to follow my recommendations, and I have a collaborator on all this work, his name is Ezekiel Emanuel. He's a physician and a bioethicist. If we had our way, we would replace the employment-based system and the income-tested system with some kind of universal voucher system where everyone had coverage for a basic plan, and where you funded it through a simple tax, let's say just a tax on consumption. In that system, the healthy and the wealthy would be subsidizing the poor and the sick, and the middle class would be paying their own way, which in any sensible society, that's what's going to happen.
If, as you say, we have to work on controlling costs, yes, cost increases in healthcare, do we then risk some of the advances we've made in healthcare science in the past decades?
Absolutely. There's no free lunch. The main reason why healthcare costs rise every year is new technologies. Now, some of those new technologies are wonderful. So what we need, and one of the things that Emanuel and I recommend, is an independent institute for technology assessment. Because up until now, technologies have never been evaluated in terms of their benefits relative to their costs. We need to know which of the new technologies are very valuable and worth the money, and we need to know which ones are not. But is it going to have some effect? Absolutely. There's no free lunch.
Let me back up for a second and talk again about some of the big societal issues that we
Yes.
face in this country. It's been clear over the past number of decades in this country that the rich get richer, the poor certainly get poorer, and the middle class keeps on struggling. Is there a way that we can effectively level the playing field in this country?
Yes. Yes, but strangely enough, it's not through the income tax. Many people fool themselves into thinking that you can achieve a great deal of redistribution by putting in very high tax rates on the high-income people. Actually, if you look at the example of countries like Sweden and Norway and Denmark, that's not the way they do it. The way they do it primarily is through transfer programs. In other words, if you have programs of health care which are universal, so that the poor get them just as well as the middle-income people do. If you have programs for social services, that is the most successful way to achieve redistribution in people's real living standards.
One of the things that people who are opposed to things like universal health care will say is that, listen, this is not the way the free market's supposed to work. Let's let the market mechanisms figure out how much it ought to cost, who's going to get covered, and let things happen that way. What's your response?
My response is this, that there are several good things I want and I think most people want. I want efficiency and I want justice. I want freedom and I want security. Now, as an economist, I know that there have to be trade-offs. I can't have all the freedom and all the security that I would like to have. And that's where the judgment and the political balance comes in. We may have to give up a little bit of efficiency in order to get more justice. On the other hand, I would hold up a stop sign to those people who say, well, the only thing I'm interested in is security and justice, and I don't give a hang about freedom and efficiency. That's not right either. What we have, to some extent, is, I wouldn't say a polarization, but we have a lot of people who take extreme positions one way or the other. And that's not a recipe for a good society.
Victor Fuchs, thank you very much for your time.
Well, thank you, Kai. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Victor Fuchs is the Henry Kaiser Professor Emeritus of Economics at Stanford University. You can hear more about what he has to say on the future of healthcare policy on our website, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering more of what you want in a retirement plan. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, it's a word we've been using with distressing regularity since this whole shebang began 2 months ago. It's a noun and a verb, and depending on how you feel about it, not something to be uttered in polite company. Merriam-Webster said today, bailout is its 2008 word of the year. The dictionary definition, according to the dictionary people, is a rescue from financial distress. The winner was the most looked up word this year, if looked up is a word in that context. Others on the list were maverick, rogue, and vet, as in mavericks vetting their running mates. That is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow rose 36 points, 0.4%, first three-day gainer in a long time. The Nasdaq lost 7 points, 0.5%. The S&P 500 gained 5 points. That is 0.2% there. Thanks to Jennifer Collins, Renita Jablonski, and Doug Krisner on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Coming up next time on this program, smaller budgets and slimmer waists have belt makers getting creative.
We'll punch holes from the beginning of the tip to the end of the buckle. So you could actually use it as a dog leash if you want. Whatever it takes to survive.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.